pleasure to be with everyone today. Again, I think this mix of people is really important for stimulating conversation, and so again, I really appreciate the offer to come and speak with you all today. And this is going to be the test, whether the glasses need to be used at this point. We all get to that age at some point. All right. I'm going to begin by talking to you about both task forces, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force and the Task Force on Community Preventive Services. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force was reauthorized as part of the health reform legislation, and the Task Force on Community Preventive Services, although around for some time, as Georges Benjamin talked about, was authorized for the first time in the legislation. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the challenges that we have in trying to come up with the community, with the evidence base for community health improvement, and at that point I'll be focusing mostly on the work that we do in the community guide, and then how we address those challenges. So we've talked in many ways about different pieces of community health improvement planning. What do we do to try to meet the tremendous needs that we have? We just heard a lot of discussion about MATCH, or the county health rankings. There are a number of other things that people do, the community health assessments that we've talked about, that hospitals and others are doing, that identify what the problem is. And then the next thing that we often want to do, once we've figured out what problems are, is to see what kind of an objective should we try to reach for? What can we do in changing obesity rates? What should we aim for? And Healthy People 2020 often gives an identification of objectives, and then there may be other things that you use to set objectives. Well, then once you've set what you want to do, the next question becomes, what can actually help me meet those objectives? And so selecting interventions that can help address those needs. And that's where both task forces fit. Another thing that especially we on the Community Preventive Services Task Force have been doing quite a bit lately with partners, some of whom are in this room, NNPHI, the National Network of Public Health Institutes, the Public Health Foundation, and the National Association of County and City Health Officials, amongst others, are working with us on really trying to meet that implementation needs that we just heard about in our last session as well. And finally, evaluating. And of course, this is not a one-way process. It has many feedback loops, but within this, you can see pretty much where we fit. So the two task forces. Across them, they are both considered the gold standards in identifying evidence in their own areas. And this sort of shows what the scope of the two areas are. And I'll talk about this a little bit more on my subsequent slides. But the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force primarily addresses primary care offices, some things in health settings that are health system or community-based, and the Community Preventive Services Task Force has the scope that is complementary to them. So if we talk about the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force first, what are its aims? Well, the aims of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force are to evaluate the benefits of individually based clinical preventive services. And what that means is what a clinician would do with a one-on-one encounter with their patient, typically looking at their age, looking at their gender, and trying to figure out what recommendations these clinicians might be able to use within a clinical setting for prevention. And so what things should they be doing routinely? And in this case, they would be looking at things like screening. What's the effectiveness of particular screening interventions? Should we be screening for, say, colorectal cancer, yes or no? Another thing that they are attempting to do is to identify a research agenda for clinical preventive care. So in areas where they're not able to make a recommendation because there's not enough evidence, to highlight things that people need to go in and fill as gaps. Now, the recommendations are compiled together in the Guide to Clinical Preventive Services, and I've shown a diagram of a recent version here. So as I identified on that last slide, typically this is talking about the level of an individual patient, and the providers are typically doctors, nurses, or other people who are sitting in the role of a healthcare clinician. Usually the work is done at a clinical setting, and in addition to the screening tests and evaluating their effectiveness that I just spoke about, they also look at the effectiveness of preventive medicines like nicotine replacement therapy and behavior change counseling. So some examples that the clinical guide has looked at would be, what's the effectiveness of colorectal cancer screening for reducing colorectal cancer morbidity and mortality? What's the effect of screening adult patients for obesity and offering counseling and behavioral interventions? Or, for example, what's the effectiveness of screening adults for depression in reducing depression and other things that would come after that? Now, the Task Force on Community Preventive Services comes alongside of that and adds information about other areas in the community that are also critically important and are the focus of this meeting today. We focus, or the task force that we're associated with, focuses to evaluate the effectiveness of community-based preventive services. And the other thing that we also do is we evaluate the economic efficiency of all of the services we look at. That is critically important in the community area because typically the community does not have as much money as many of the health systems that we work in association with. And that economic efficiency considers things like cost effectiveness and cost benefit, but it also considers plain old cost because it doesn't matter how cost effective something is if it's $300,000 and you have $10,000 at your disposal. The second thing that the task force does is make recommendations for use of the interventions in policy and practice, and the practice would be programs and services. And we also look at research gaps and things that we would encourage people to fill in to provide more information that can be used by people in the real-world settings. And the recommendations of this task force are put together in the Guide to Community Preventive Services, or the Community Guide for short. Now, what are the community preventive services? What I've done is talk here about the fact that most of what we do is look at things at the group level. We are looking at things that are effective at the level of a population, perhaps effective at the level of a neighborhood or a school or a work site. And because of the large number of different kinds of things we look at, a wide range of providers may be involved in delivering these kinds of services. It could be a policymaker, it could be someone sitting as a nurse in a school setting. There's a wide range of providers. So if we take those three areas that we looked at in clinical preventive services, the first being colorectal cancer screening, if the colorectal cancer screening is identified as effective for certain populations, as the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has said it is, then we might come in and say, what are community-level things that can be done to support someone getting to the point of care where a clinician can then deliver screening? So we might look at what's the effectiveness of incentivizing clients to come. What's the effectiveness of handing out pamphlets, something that everybody always wants to do? And then we also look at health system things. So what's the effectiveness of providing providers with assessment and feedback, a healthcare system intervention, and does that increase colorectal cancer screening? So this example shows how some of what we do, the provider, comes right up alongside of the healthcare clinician. Other things are more distal in the community, but all of the things are aiming to bring people to a point of care in the examples that we've identified here. Now, there are four different areas that we cover within community preventive services, and I'll go through each of them here. The first would be looking at the effectiveness of informational or educational kinds of interventions. So what's the effectiveness of mass media campaigns for trying to reduce alcohol-impaired driving, for example? The second area that we look at is behavioral and social interventions. And here, for example, what's the effectiveness of behavioral interventions, comprehensive risk reduction and abstinence education strategies in reducing risky sexual behavior in youth and their exposure, therefore, to HIV, sexually transmitted diseases, and pregnancy? A third area would be the effectiveness of environmental and policy interventions. So we've looked at the effectiveness of street-scale urban design. So if you improve the lighting in your area, if you improve safety, if you make it easier for people to walk, does that actually cause them to increase their physical activity? And smoking bans and restrictions. How effective are those in reducing environmental tobacco smoke, something that's been really important in many communities? The fourth area in which we look at interventions and their effectiveness in is health system interventions. And those are the things that are usually most closely associated with the work of the clinicians and the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. So here we might look at something like diabetes management programs and how can some of these things within the healthcare system and then supported in the community, do they contribute to diabetes control? Now, why were these two task forces created in the first place? Well, the idea was to be able to pull together the best available evidence to support decision-making through a process that was all of these things, independent, not politically motivated, transparent, systematic, having a process that was credible, having a process that was well-vetted, and really importantly, a process that was useful, not just something that would produce academic articles that could not be used by people. Now, I always like to start here because I'm a Canadian, and the whole genesis of this activity started in Canada. The provincial health ministers, and health is a provincial jurisdiction in Canada, just like it is a state jurisdiction here, and they wanted to determine what they should include and pay for in the periodic health exam. And so they asked people to come together and make recommendations. Well, this was so successful that they decided to do the same thing in the United States, and this was the genesis of the clinical guide. At that same time, in the 80s, people in the community public health area went, gee, wouldn't it be great if we could do something like this? It took a full 12 years of additional work to get anybody to be even willing to look at the concept of doing this in community areas. There was hostility at the beginning because people thought, we have laws that we use. We have all of these other things, and how are you going to take what's used in evidence-based medicine and expect us to have the same standards? And so we have worked over the time since we were established and even before to build credibility for the fact that you can also look at the evidence in community areas. So the Community Preventive Services Task Force was established in 1996, and it was established as a resource for all of public health with staff support provided by CDC, and also a task force was established at that time under David Satcher. Now, both of the task forces use a very similar rigorous process. State-of-the-science systematic reviews that are aimed at evaluating evidence, making recommendations for practice and policy, and highlighting research gaps. Both of the task forces have very similar structures. As I identified before, these are independent, non-federal panels of experts. They are at the level of a federal advisory committee, but they are independent so that they are able to make recommendations that are science-based and not affected by other things that are going on. The task forces oversee priority setting, help set up topics and interventions for review. They actually are involved in the conduct of the individual reviews, and they make recommendations, and this is very important. They don't make recommendations for federal agencies. They are mandated to make recommendations for U.S. decision makers across a wide range. One of those groups may be federal decision makers who come to that just like everyone else. And it's also important to note that the people who serve on these task forces serve without payment so that they maintain their independence. Now, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force is staffed by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, and CDC staffs the Community Preventive Services Task Force. Now, I'd also like to take just one moment and talk to you about some of the other systematic review groups, because people say, well, how does this relate to Cochrane? How does this relate to CAMEL? There's all of these groups. Who am I supposed to listen to? The best way to think about this is that there are two different groupings of systematic reviews. The first is people whose intent is to inform policy and practice decisions. So what they are expected to do is to bring information together, to summarize the literature, and then leave it up to other people to take that and figure out how they're going to use this. Now, some other groups, the two preventive task forces that I've talked about, as well as NICE in the UK, and some other international groups, including GRAVE, have been asked to go the extra mile. Not only are we supposed to pull the evidence together, but we are actually supposed to make formal recommendations that helps in the ability for people to use things so that they don't have to pull through the articles themselves. We do, however, work together very closely. Both of the two task forces work with Cochrane and Campbell as we do our work. The Cochrane area has just come out with a public health field. The Campbell area now has a health equity field. So we work very closely together. And so when you're looking at the evidence base, you actually, most of us work very hard to not duplicate the work that each other does. All right, so I was going to show you the Community Guide website. What I will do is just talk about the Community Preventive Services Task Force. The really important thing about the task force are that its members are renowned experts in research, yes, but also in practice and policy. At all times, we have representatives from state and local health on the task force. The current chair is the Director of Public Health and the Health Officer for LA County, Dr. Fielding. We have over 220 task force recommendations right now. We have a broad range of topics and risk behaviors. We look at things in the area of health equity. We have reviews in a large number of areas, and that information will be available to you after. And I'll make sure you see the website at the end if it's up by that time. So how is the Community Guide used? Well, the Community Guide is used to inform decision-making in a number of important areas, to inform practice, to provide information that informs policy decisions, research, and it also can provide information to funders, people who want to fund programs or people who want to fund research. Let me tell you about the typical way that systematic reviews are done. In the past, what we used to do was what I called a push model, where the experts would get together, and they would look at the literature, and they would decide what the answers were, and then they would basically shove them out on people in the real world and say, okay, now you're expected to use these, and then they would wonder why that didn't happen. So we actually try very hard to, we've put up our whole system so that we do not do this.
And we actually believe that if you are expecting people to use the findings, then you need to actively engage those individuals, not just in disseminating what you do, but actually in doing the systematic reviews themselves so that these things become more relevant to what they do. So therefore, we place equal weight not just on the methods of the analysis, but also on our group processes. So intended users, how do we involve these people in our reviews? Well, they're involved in our prioritization process. Are we asking the right questions? They help us stay true to the right questions over the course of our review. They help us consider context, issues of applicability to different settings and situations. They help us think about use at the back end and help us plan for getting information out to people from the beginning. So who do we involve in our reviews? Well, whoever is expected to be affected by the recommendations can be involved in the reviews that we do. So we have a series of different people who are involved in the guide. We have a series of liaisons who are have official status with the task force. There are 30 federal agency and organizational liaisons. Many of the departments in Health and Human Services and other federal agencies, all of the armed forces, our usual suspects, ASTO, Nature, NALBO, the Public Health Foundation, the APHA, American Medical Association, Association of Schools of Public Health, nursing organizations, and they sit with the task force. Our meetings are public, and they sit with the task force. They provide input into prioritization and reviews. They serve on review teams, and they participate in dissemination and translation to their constituents. The reviews themselves are done by teams of people, not a scientist in an office, but we have between 10 and 15 people who serve on teams, and that includes guide scientists, people from CDC, and people throughout academic policy and practice settings. So, for example, our worksite reviews, we had a VP from Coca-Cola and union members on the teams to help us really ask the right questions. And so there are a large number of people, also consultants, that help with each of the individual reviews. So another really important thing to let you know is that what we are concerned about is not just whether something works under controlled populations, which is efficacy, but also, is this going to really work in a large range of settings? So a lot of decision makers don't really care about controlled settings. They either care about, are the findings generalizable to all of the settings for which I am responsible, or are the findings applicable to my specific population right here? So what we do here is set up a number of our analytic processes to try to get at this applicability, and the people that are involved in the reviews help us do this. So the community guide seeks to answer a number of questions. The first is, not just do they work, but how well, for whom, under what circumstances they're appropriate, how much they cost, whether they provide value, whether there's barriers to their use, whether there's any harms, or whether there's any unanticipated consequences. And so the task force pulls all of the information together. Now, we look at a range of information. We do not just look at published literature. We look at the gray literature. We look at evaluation reports. We pull information together, and we look at the quality of the evidence, the number of studies, and then we look at the consistency of the effect. Do most of the studies show the same thing? And then not just is the effect statistically significant, but is it meaningful in a population frame? And it's important to note here that we look at evaluation, practice-based research as well as or practice-based information as well as research testing. We also do a formal review of applicability, as I talked to you about, and provide this information in the form of a rationale statement to the task force. The task force writes this, and so it helps users see issues in which we've been able to look at applicability. The challenge, however, is that that information on applicability is always limited. And so I have a strong urging role for many of you who are responsible for programs. If you do good program evaluations and put that information together, then that information can come back and contribute the next time we update those areas, and we can provide better information for a broader range of users. So the task force can recommend for or against an intervention on the basis of its effectiveness. Or it can recommend, or it can identify that there's insufficient evidence at the current time to recommend for or against. So what does this insufficient evidence mean? It doesn't mean the intervention doesn't work. It just means that right now we really don't know. We've looked at the evidence, and there's not enough for us to be able to come to a conclusion. So if you see insufficient evidence as a finding, then what do you do? Well, If you're currently using that intervention, you may want to continue using it if there's no harms, or you may want to stop using it if it ends up being very expensive. So if you aren't using an intervention, then you may want to consider, are there some other ways that I can reach my ends where there's a lot of evidence for effectiveness? Or if you look at areas and you cannot find something that meets your needs, you may look in your proposal for funding, say, to say, the evidence is insufficient in this area. I'd like to try something innovative, and I plan on collecting data so that I can put that information forward and help other people make decisions in the future. If you do have a recommendation, if the task force has recommended something on the basis of strong or sufficient evidence, it's still not a cookbook solution. You still have to take that information, that science-based information, and combine it with information on the needs and values and preferences of your communities. And so the community guide in this frame attempts to provide menus of options so that you can go in and look and be informed about the decisions that you want. We provide information on what the evidence says that you can combine with what will work best in your community. So I was just ending with saying, how can you use the community guide? And there's a whole list of things, again, that I'll just try to go through quickly. You can use the guide to plan and evaluate programs, to strengthen applications for funding, to justify funding applications. You're going to see more and more that people are asking to use evidence-based approaches, to plan and modify systems. This idea of how much of an effect might you expect. And you may also want be able to identify laws and policies for which there is evidence of effectiveness. And it can also help you when you're talking to federal government agencies. We have actually heard from the local boards of health and the counties that this is the first time they've ever been able to talk together with a tool that allows them to communicate. And then the boards of health can go and advocate for, or depending upon whether they're governing or otherwise, make decisions for their local counties. And I was going to end with showing you the website and where you could go for more information. I'd be happy to. I think these slides are going to be available to everyone so people can just see that information there. And thank you for your imaginations.